We're glad you're joining us here at NRCC Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts.
So, when you start the long journey of rethinking religion, it's not very long before you end up rethinking sexuality. Because sexuality and spirituality, our tradition tells us, are deeply interwoven. It's very difficult to extricate them from one another. Now, before we even begin this introductory lesson, I bet that that feels a little bit jangly. The whole idea that sexuality and spirituality are deeply interwoven, I thought we were going to talk about sex, Doug. Doug, what is this, some kind of a bait and switch thing? No. Well, one of the themes that you're going to hear throughout this lesson is that how we think about our sexuality has been tragically reduced by forces in our culture that have brought about this reduced understanding of what sexuality means. We have taken a vast part of our humanity, reduced it down to a narrow sliver, and we've called that sexuality. So consequently, when we go about rethinking sex education, we do so on a foundation that is not nearly adequate to sustain a rethinking endeavor. As we go through this lesson, my hope is that you will hear some terms redefined, that you will end up walking away with a sense that sexuality that is so deep within us is a much bigger thing than we have been taught, and that we will be set up to then build on that broader foundation a sexual education for ourselves and for our young people that will be sustainable and healthy and make and bring about well-being. So, and as you've been hearing since last spring, I've been asking every month or so, what topics do you think we should cover in this lesson? And so while I will draw from the book, the lesson will be more organized around those questions that you submitted, those thoughts and those topics that you submitted. And then sometimes what you submit through Mentee, I grab that as well. But here's a question that represents several that were submitted, you know, on those slips of paper. Does God have a plan for sex, and what does the Bible say about sex? That's one way that the question was submitted, but it came in several different forms over those months, and let me kind of tell you the context for it. What this cluster of thoughts were saying was, Doug, this is a really tough moment in history. Because the way that we used to think about sexuality, the way that we used to think about sex education, religion's way, it kind of didn't work. And but then we were so committed to God and we were so committed to the process that even though it kind of didn't work, we kept doing it and we kept doing it. And part of the reason we kept going was because it's easy. Because all you have to know is God said X and God said Y. And then all you have to do is do X and do Y. And if you do that, we don't have to do all this rethinking stuff. And so there was a point of wisdom at one point to the X and to the Y, and maybe that wisdom got lost on the long way, or maybe we got it right, but hey, let's just keep doing that. Now, if you grew up in a non-religious sex education, that's you don't even know what we're talking about. But if you grew up in religion and you grew up with that being the source of your sex education, that thought came up a lot. And so the premise is of these questions, this cluster of questions, was the traditional religious sex education, it kind of isn't working anymore. And as a matter of fact, the subtext of many of them was, it kind of hurt. It kind of hurt me personally. And I don't want to perpetuate that hurt on my kids. But many of the questions said, that was way over here on the pendulum. And when the pendulum swung all the way over to here, that side didn't work very well either. Because I've also tried the no rules, no guidelines approach, or basically if you use a condom or if you make sure there's consent, but that's the very minimal guideline. If we do that, that didn't work very well for me either. And it kind of made intercourse not much more meaningful than just dinner and a movie. And something there also gets lost, and something there also doesn't speak to the deep parts of my soul. And then also, over on this side, things could get a little crazy. You just watch the news, you realize things have gotten a little crazy. So the question runs, what is the plan? What is the wisdom? What does God say? What does the Bible say? What that's saying is, where does the authoritative voice speak to how we should practice our sexuality? Where do we get clear and helpful insight into this deep and pretty troubled part of our shared humanity? Now, that's a question that captures a historical moment. When we are in between worldviews, in between social norms that are built on that worldview, and the new norms have not yet emerged for the new worldview, well, things just don't work. And if you look around in our society right now, we realize that that is kind of what's happening. Our governing systems are not working very well. Our education systems, our business systems, our family systems, things that were pretty stable when we lived in the old worldview, don't work as well in the new worldview. And social norms that used to be pretty stable in the old worldview, now, not so much. So God, we need. Bible, we need. Wisdom, we need. Now, we've all seen our social institutions going through this process of deconstruction, maybe pretty soon to be reconstruction, but it's difficult from where we stand in history at this moment to know how things are going to turn out. It's very difficult to be able to look ahead and say, this is what the new institutions will look like, this is what the new norms will be. It's hard to see from where we are today. And our social norms around sex, how we practice sexuality with one another, how we teach our young people about sexuality, what we encourage and what we discourage, that is so much up in the air right now. And we've got young people now. We are living sexual lives now. And sure, 100 years from now, social norms will be reconstructed to help us, but what good is that going to do us 100 years from now? We are living in this moment. So we need a plan. We need God's plan, or we need the Bible's plan, or we need the voice of wisdom. So that's the question. Let's talk about that. But let's talk about it in kind of a roundabout way. And I told you last week we were not going to do any emotionally evocative, challenging, hard-to-contain things. Ah, oh, darn. Little bit. I found out in the last lesson, yeah, that's still an issue. Because we're going to talk about the Bible. And here's the thing about the Bible. As soon as we start talking about what is happening with our Christian view of the Bible, it evokes all kinds of internal discomfort. So I apologize in advance for internal discomfort, and I do want to say we spent 10 years working on that because it is a fundamental core question, and I captured a lot of that process in the book. And if I tell you what it says in the book, there won't be enough time to talk about sex. So I'm going to say some things and not give a lot of background behind them, and then that's going to be tough. So I apologize in advance, and I do say, hey, get the book. All right, so this roundabout way, I think, is going to be worth the detour because it's going to build a framework for this whole lesson. So here we go. When a worldview shifts, the most emotionally difficult part isn't the loss of the institutional norms or even the social norms. The most emotionally difficult part when we shift from one worldview to another is that we lose the source of trusted authority. Where we used to go to get wisdom, where we used to go to get answers, that shifts and changes. And that is emotionally very, very difficult. 500 years ago was the last time we in the West went through this worldview shift that we're going through right now. And when that happened, we shifted our source of authority from the Pope or from the priest or from the church's hierarchy, and we left that behind and we went to a new source. Because the religious hierarchy stopped working for people, and it was no longer trusted. It was no longer someone that we could access and find that kind of wisdom. So what we did is we demoted the Pope, and we demoted the priest, and in their place we put the Bible. And that worked really well for many generations until it didn't. Now, this is the part that's going to get a little emotional, because what I'm about to say is this. We've had lots of ways that we've looked at authority through our tradition. It's only been the last 500 years that we've elevated the Bible above the rest. And so what we're talking about in our time isn't getting rid of the Bible. Many are. Many just don't pay attention to it anymore. What we're talking about is bringing the Bible back to its own historical place among the other sources of authority, which I'll name in a moment. So I know that's going to be, it's going to sound like the Bible's bad, throw it out. We're not saying that. We're saying that we caricatured the Bible and made it something different 500 years ago, and now we're trying to bring it back into where it's been historically. So when you go through a shift in your worldview and you shift the source to which you appeal for authority, that's emotional. Well, those words sound pretty sane, pretty normal. But when you're going through it, it is so emotionally demanding. The last time we did it, we burned each other at the stake because it was so painful and so difficult. And we're living through this kind of transition, questioning the sources for which we go for wisdom and truth and authority now, and it is very, very emotionally difficult. We are losing the foundation on which everything is built. How we think about our personal lives, how we build our society, how we live in our institutions, everything is being rocked to the core. And there's so much anxiety, we would feel tempted to do what they did 500 years ago, and that is start burning each other at the stake. But 100 years from now, all this will be sorted out, and here we are living through it. And one of the things that's happening is we're questioning the source to which we have gone for our authority, and we're questioning the Bible. Now, once the Bible made things feel solid, and now the Bible does not make things feel solid. One era's authoritative source of wisdom, one era's authoritative access to the voice of God is inexorably giving way to whatever comes next. And whatever comes next is not immediately visible. And so consequently, some of the tension that we feel is we're losing what we had and we don't yet have what we will have. And in this in-between time, it is very challenging. Someday it will be second nature to appeal to the new source of authority, but for now it is not. So as you can see, the question on that slip of paper and one that came up last week during What Are You Thinking are really important questions, much bigger than they appear, because we want something solid, we want something that we can count on, especially in something as deep and intimate as our sexuality. So we want it to be with the authority of God's plan or the biblical view. Because that was where we went for authority, and now it's challenging to make that our authority. As an aside, many Christians still insist that the Bible is the authoritative source of all wisdom and insight, but if we just take a snapshot of how we live as the church, it's very clear that while we are giving lip service to that, it's not what we are doing. We are kind of cherry-picking. We are kind of deciding. We aren't living as though the Bible is the authority, but we still don't have the new authority, so we are saying with our mouths that we are, and that disconnect makes it very difficult to be in the church right now. So I say that to say you're not going to hear a lot of Bible verses as we go through this lesson. It won't be framed around a quest to find the words of God. But that does bring up a really good question. If we don't go to the Bible to get the answers, the wisdom, the insight exclusively, where do we go? How do we find our understanding of what is good and true and beautiful? What is the wisdom to which we appeal? Now, again, I wrote a book. And again, I wish you would read it because I feel a little bit self-conscious, jumping right into these things on the basis of assumptions that took a long time to hammer out. But a few things about what I did say in the book about that authority question. So what I said a moment ago is true. We only elevated the status of the Bible 500 years ago, but you and I didn't know that because we weren't living 600 years ago. We didn't know what it was like to be outside of the Roman influenced church, what it was like to be in the Eastern Orthodox church, or what it was like to be in the Coptic church, or what it was like to be in the Celtic church. All we know is that the Bible was where we went. But what we used to do, and what we've done in other contexts, is we have accessed many sources of authority, many sources of wisdom, and it's been a messy process because those sources often seem inconsistent, sometimes even contradict one another. And those sources have been the written scriptures, the texts that we recognize as holy, the accumulated wisdom of tradition, and that is things that have been done this way because we learned something and we kept on doing that thing, personal experience, the discerning of the interior voice, reason, the ability to figure things out in our heads, and community, that we discern wisdom better together than we do alone. There have been five sources to which we, in our tradition, have appealed for wisdom. If you've ever heard of Wesley, he had a thing called the quadrilateral, and he said, so there it is, it's a scripture, and it's tradition, and it's reason, and it's personal experience. We added community because if you look back through the whole thing, community is just interwoven all the time. But the reason that we unelevated these and we extra elevated the Bible was that 500 years ago, the worldview that we were just entering into was even more uncomfortable with messy, even more uncomfortable with uncertain than we usually are as human beings. So consequently, because we were hyper uncomfortable with uncertain, we elevated the Bible because when we try and put them all together and hear what they all say, it's really messy and it really doesn't feel solid and doesn't feel certain. So we elevated the Bible and we said, sola. That's a Latin word, it means only. Sola scriptura. What we said is that and that alone. That's the only source that we go to for our reference. You might have heard that if you took a class on the Reformation when you were in school. So we streamlined things and in the process made the Bible something that the Bible never purported to be and something that our history never made the Bible until we hit that moment. Boy, it made things easier. All we had to do was just go to the Bible and get the answers. And as soon as we went to the Bible to get the answers, we're good. Except, I went to the Bible and I got the answers, and you went to the Bible and you got a different answer. And now, I'm sorry, I can't go to church with you anymore. When we first decided that we were going to do this, we had two denominations, and that was only because the Roman Empire had split into two parts. After we decided that this is what we're going to do, elevate the Bible, we went quickly from two denominations to currently there are 41,000 Christian denominations. 41,000 times we have said, I've read the Bible, I figured out what it says, it is true. You don't agree? I can't go to church with you anymore. And it didn't occur to us along the way that, you know what, maybe our Newtonian worldview version of elevating the Bible above the status of the others, maybe that was the problem. That never occurred to us. We just determined that we've got the truth, you don't have the truth, I can't go to church with you. So, when we elevated the Bible to standalone status, it made things less messy, it made things comfortingly more easy, it was historically helpful, but it was not a big enough narrative about the Bible to withstand the sands of time. So, where do we go for our source of wisdom? We'll go back in history, and we'll go back to the messiness. We'll go back to all of those sources. We're not going to get rid of the Bible. We're just going to put the Bible in line with all of those others. We're going to look at tradition. We're going to look at personal experience. We're going to look at reason, and we're going to look at community. And when we do those, it will be messy. And when we do that, we might get it wrong. But the alternative is to act like we're not getting it wrong when we really are. So that's the challenge for our generation, is to wade through the messy. Well, all of that background that you might have noticed has nothing to do with sex is to let you know how we're going to approach this lesson. We're going to approach it in a messy way. We're going to try out this source of authority and then compare and contrast it with that source of authority, and then we're going to do it again with all of the others, and all the while, our brain tricks are going to be going off inside of us, trying to bias us in favor of some predetermined thing that we would prefer. It is really messy. And I can imagine people saying, Doug, I just want some easy-to-follow guidelines. I got to raise these kids. Doug, I just want to figure out my sexuality. I do not want to have to grapple through this historical moment. Thank you very much for the context, but we really just need how to have healthy sexual lives. Well, that's kind of why I wrote the book. I figure a little bit that should be the minister's job to do all that weighting and comparing and contrasting. Now, I put enough in the book to kind of help you understand what I was doing, why I was doing it, but we do come down to a series of pretty easy to transmit guidelines at the end, but it's based on the understanding of what got us here and how, where do we go from here. Guidelines that will help us live wisely to have healthy sexual lives, but it won't be a list of Bible verses. You're going to be more likely to hear helpful and healthy than you are going to hear right and wrong. You're going to be more likely to hear insight and wisdom and less about guidelines and rules. So, that's the introduction. That's the part that says, this is going to be going on while we're talking about this lesson. So now you understand why last week was the preamble. You needed the introduction before we get started. Now let me just give you a little hint of where we're going to go in terms of a bigger sexuality. That's going to be an important theme for everything that we do in this lesson, to understand that we have been sold a very reductionist view of human sexuality, and we're going to need to go back into that and re-expand it out and make it big enough. Because one of the things we suffer from in trying to solve problems like consent or problems like when is a person ready to be sexually active, we can't think about those things because we've reduced this thing down to too small a foundation. We need a broader foundation on which to build. We need a bigger sexuality. So let me start with this. Sexuality is to biology as spirituality is to going to church. In other words, going to church, being part of a weekly rhythm of spiritual practice, connecting with the community in a patterned way, there's some spirituality in that. And that would mean, yes, there is some overlap between spirituality and church, but maybe not as big an overlap as I drew on that Venn diagram. Those circles might be further apart. Because if we reduce our spirituality to church, we suffer a gross deficit. Because there's much more that goes on in containing the inner divine, in accessing the inner voice, the fruit of the indwelling spirit that can be accessed on a Sunday morning during this hour and that. Also, the place that we access the divine can't be limited to a church room. That also happens in nature. It also happens in family. It happens in our lovers. It happens in books. It happens in conversations. It happens everywhere we go. There is nowhere that we go that we do not have access to spirituality. So, spirituality is to going to church as sexuality is to biology. And again, I might have overlapped those circles too much. To see our sexuality exclusively in terms of biology is to do a grave disservice to how deeply in our humanity our sexuality runs. In all the years of our tradition, those who have experienced first-hand encounter with the divine, we called them our mystics, our mystical tradition. When they tried to describe their experience of first-hand encounter with the divine, when they tried to point us in the direction of a similar experience, they almost always stumbled onto sexuality as a way of talking about this deep first-hand encounter spirituality. Again and again, that's where their experience took them, that sexuality is such a deep part of us, the best way to describe it is sexuality. Sexuality is such a deep part of us, the best way to describe it is spirituality. Spirituality is such a deep part of us, the best way to describe it is sexuality. It is too big to contain in words, too big to be able to even think through adequately. We can never think to ourselves, aha, I have arrived at the destination of the spiritual journey. Never. But it's just as true that we can never say, aha, I have arrived at the destination of the sexual journey. It's not possible to come to the end of the sexual journey, even when we're old, even when biological hunger fades into the background, or when someone to share our bed with is a far distant memory. Sexuality is still alive and well. Sexuality is a compelling force within us, a drive of the deepest part of our souls, much bigger than biology. It is a prime driver deep in our beings that moves us toward, compels us toward, connecting and creating. Our sexuality is our deep primal drive to connect and to create. We do that with our bodies. We do that with our biology. But if I were to draw another diagram up there, I would have drawn a big circle and said, sexuality. And then I would have drawn a little circle within that and said, biology. The drive to connect and the drive to create is so intertwined with our sexuality, they are one and the same. And when we follow sexuality's bedrock energy and travel the full journey that it sets before us, that journey, as we'll see next week, is transformative. And when we take this transformative process so deeply ingrained in us and we reduce it down to just getting laid, we do to ourselves this careless mislaying of a core part of our humanity. Now, I alluded to this last week, but part of the reason we do that is because since about the 50s, in our society, most of the core institutions in our society have either been hamstrung or overwhelmed to the degree that they don't offer us a viable sex education. So the primary institution right now that is educating us about our sex is business, because they certainly figured out how deeply sexuality runs, and they constantly school us in a trivialized version of sexuality, the version that they use to keep us in a constant state of desire, a constant state of unconsummation. And then they use that dissatisfied longing to sell us stuff. And they say, that deep hunger of your heart, it will be met if you buy this body cologne. It will be met if you drive this kind of car. You will have that deep connection that you see on the screen there if you will drink this kind of beer. And they are the ones who are schooling us on what equals sexuality. They're telling us what it is, and then they're using that to fleece us. And we can't but absorb some part of that reductionist version of sexuality. I'm going to read for you a quote in a moment, and after that quote, one of the people in the first service spoke up and said, you're going to have to explain that, Doug, because that sexuality, that doesn't seem like sexuality. That stuff's way too big to fit in sexuality, to which I thought, ha, that's what we're going to talk about. We'll try and recover the bigger version of sexuality to access and then teach our young people to access that deepest inner drive to connect and that deepest inner drive to create. And once we do, once we access this deeper reality about our sexuality, then that will inform us how we then go talk about the practicalities. How will we deploy our penises and our vaginas in a way that is healthy and brings about well-being? How do we focus our romance and our passion and our sexual hunger? We can think about our biology once we've laid out the humanity that absorbs this much larger version. Once we access the deeper sexuality, then we can take care of the practicality. So let me end with this to help us see the essential framework that's coming in the lesson, a glimpse of that bigger sexuality. This is the quote. The author's name is Ronald Rollheiser. He's a poet. He's a theologian. He's a philosopher. And he wrote this book. It's called The Shattered Lantern. Let me read it to you. When you see a young mother beaming with delight at her child without a thought of selfishness, that is sexuality in full bloom. A proud grandfather watching his grandson receive his diploma with eyes filled with compassion and altruism and joy, that is sexuality in full bloom. An artist, after long frustration, looking on a work with such satisfaction that all else is blotted out, that is sexuality in full bloom. An elderly nun who, having never slept with a man, never having been married or given birth to a child, but through years of selfless service, has a face lined deeply with compassion and love, that is sexuality in full bloom. A community gathered around a grave, consoling one another so that life can go on, this is sexuality in full bloom. A table surrounded by family with laughing, arguing, and sharing life, that is sexuality in full bloom. Any person man, woman, or child, caught up in a moment of service or affection or love or friendship or compassion, having for that moment lost him or herself, is in that instant experiencing sexuality in full bloom. And to understand that that is where this journey takes us is to understand how much bigger it is than hooking up the plumbing, how much bigger it is than the idea of romance or the idea of how we look or the idea of how we behave that gets projected to us through this constant barrage. It isn't about that. That's such a small, small part of it. Now that quote by Rollheiser is not a roadmap to the sexual journey that is often laid out before us. That's not a roadmap that has been charted for us by those who are interested in selling us stuff. But what it is a roadmap that takes us to the deepest human fulfillment that is wired into our core drives to connect and our core drives to create. So before we can think about consent, before we can think about when you should start having sex, before we can think about any of the practical things that we really do have to think about, we must first ask, what is human sexuality? How deeply does it go? When we walk the sexual journey, what are the landmarks that we see along the way as we go? And that's what I hope to do in the first part of this lesson before we get to the practical things. And I do hope you'll read the book as a companion for the lesson. So indwelling spirit, bigger lives, bigger souls, bigger truth, and a bigger sexuality. May that be our experience. Amen.
If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, northraleighcommunitychurch.org. The donate button is at the top of the page on your computer's browser, at the bottom on your phone's browser. Thank you.